Finally for this hour, Emma Fielding reads more from Elizabeth's Women, Tracy Borman's biography of Elizabeth I, which explores the relationships that she had with the women in her life. Court affairs and the duties of her new ladies-in-waiting and maids of honour are the topics in part three.
By the time Elizabeth inherited the throne, England was racked by religious division, political uncertainty, economic hardship, and disastrous foreign wars. Against the aging barren Bloody Mary, Elizabeth was a shining symbol of youth and hope, and ascended the throne on a wave of popular support. But to win the respect of her ministers and subjects, she must first win their love. She therefore set about planning a series of carefully crafted public relations exercises. The first and most important was her coronation. Elizabeth's inspiration was that staged by her mother 25 years earlier. This would be the first demonstration of the elaborate symbolism and image cultivation for which Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen, and Gloriana would become so famous. Lavish scenery was constructed to line her processional route, and one of the vignettes included a representation of Anne as queen. As a further tribute to her mother, she adopted the same manner of dress, with a heavily brocaded silk surcoat and a mantle of ermine. By far the most significant imagery borrowed from her mother's coronation was the notion of the queen as a Virgin Mary on earth. As with so many of Anne's ideas, she would make it her own, but better. Elizabeth did not just mimic the Virgin Mary. She became her, untouched and untouchable, a divine presence here on earth. This was the image that would win her the love and devotion of her subjects and secure her a place in history. The new queen made a point of establishing her court as a spectacle of glorious, ostentatious display, a theatre of art, music, dancing and lavish dress. Elizabeth fully appreciated how politically important it was to stage an obvious display of wealth and majesty at court. Her banquets were always spectacular. On one occasion, an entire menagerie was sculpted in sugarwork, including camels, lions, frogs, snakes and dolphins, along with more fantastical figures like mermaids and unicorns. Elizabeth would be offered tens, if not hundreds, of separate dishes during the course of one banquet. Her first course might comprise a choice of beef, mutton, veal, swan, goose, or capon, while the second provided lamb, heron, pheasant, chicken, pigeon, and lark. Baked fruits and custards would be served with each course, and the pièce de résistance would be the exquisitely crafted confectionery. All of this was washed down with wine and ale. However decadent the court entertainments might seem to the casual observer, they were carefully controlled by Elizabeth. Ever watchful of her reputation as a young, unmarried queen, she was determined to ensure that merriment would never descend into drunkenness, nor flirtatiousness into sexual transgression. By the time she became queen, Elizabeth was already surrounded by a tightly knit group of female attendants. Principal among them were Cat Astley and Blanche Parry, who had both served her for more than 20 years. Cat was appointed Chief Gentlewoman of the Privy Chamber, the most prestigious post in the royal household, and Blanche was appointed Second Gentlewoman of the Privy Chamber. The new queen also showed favour to ladies who were associated with her late stepmother, Catherine Parr, and she appointed a significant number of women from Anne Boleyn's side of the family. The Privy Chamber lists contain regular mentions of the Carys, Knowleses, Howards and other Boleyn relatives. A rather more personal piece of evidence reveals Elizabeth's true feelings towards her mother. One of her most cherished possessions, in a collection of jewellery that comprised thousands of items, was a comparatively simple ring, fashioned from mother of pearl and embossed with tiny rubies and diamonds. It opened to reveal two portraits. One was of the Queen herself. The other was of a lady wearing a French hood. She stares directly ahead, and her features are remarkably similar to Elizabeth's. The lady was Anne Boleyn. The competition for places in the royal household was fierce, for the Queen's household was one of the very few institutions in which women had a role to play. Her ladies were indispensable, not just for practical reasons, but because everywhere the Queen went, she was flanked by an entourage who served to emphasise her peerless beauty and magnificence. And no woman should outshine the Queen. Thus, while Elizabeth appeared at court bedecked in lavish gowns of vivid colours, her ladies were obliged to wear only black or white. The structure of her household was also carefully controlled by the new Queen, and was reflected by the layout of the Queen's suite of rooms in the royal palaces. The further a courtier was able to progress into them, the more important they were deemed to be. First, there was the presence chamber, to which most courtiers flocked in the hope of gaining an audience with the Queen. Beyond this, there was the privy chamber, a day room for the sovereign, where she tended to take her meals. Only the most exalted members of court were admitted. Still more exclusive was the Queen's bedchamber. It was exceptionally rare for any male courtier to gain admittance to this inner sanctum, for it was here that Elizabeth would seek refuge from the hustle and bustle of the court. Here the Queen would be served by a small number of her most trusted ladies. They would see the private face that she kept hidden in the public rooms beyond. After the chief and second gentlewomen of the privy chamber, there were the ladies of the bedchamber, followed by the ladies of the privy chamber, and finally, the ladies of the presence chamber. In addition, there were the maids of honour, unmarried young ladies whose presence was largely decorative and who could move between the three chambers. Lower down the scale, there were the chamberers, who undertook most of the menial duties, such as cleaning, laundry, and mending. Elizabeth herself admitted that she was always surrounded by my ladies of the bedchamber and maids of honour. At least one of them would sleep in the same room as her, usually upon a truckle bed at the end of the Queen's own bed. Whatever she wished for, day or night, they would make it their business to procure at any cost. Service to the Queen was certainly no sinecure. Elizabeth expected all of her women to be in constant attendance upon her, and to put her needs above any personal concerns. Illness, unless very severe, was no excuse for absence, neither was marriage or domestic matters. The new Queen viewed marriage as an irritating disruption to her routine. If any of her ladies fell pregnant, they were expected to return to court as soon as possible after the birth, leaving their offspring to the care of wet nurses. The ladies of the presence chamber were only required to attend when the Queen's Majesty calleth for them, which was usually when she granted audiences to ambassadors or other prestigious guests. The maids of honour provided the necessary backdrop on less formal occasions and were otherwise to be found running errands for their royal mistress. For the ladies of the privy chamber and bedchamber, the duties were more closely defined. They would wash her, attend to her makeup and coiffure, choose her clothes and jewels, and assist her in putting them on, serve her food and drink, and carry out any other task she saw fit to demand. Service for the ladies of her household followed a strict routine. Elizabeth herself admitted, "I am no mourning woman," and she would eschew the company of her male counsellors and suitors until she had been dressed and adorned. By the standards of the day, the Queen was unusually fastidious and would take regular baths in a specially made tub that travelled with her from palace to palace. On other occasions, she would be washed by her ladies with cloths soaked in water from pewter bowls. They would clean her teeth with a range of largely ineffective products, including a concoction of white wine and vinegar boiled up with honey, which would be rubbed on with fine cloths. This task performed, it would take at least an hour to dress Elizabeth. Each layer of clothing, from the farthingales and bodices to the outer garments, ruffs and scented gloves, had to be carefully fastened into place with pins and laces. Often the gowns had to be sewn on each day, and then the stitches carefully unpicked before she retired at night. It was essential that this unmarried queen should be accompanied by her ladies at all times, in order to avoid any slur on her reputation. Her ladies would attend her as she progressed in state to chapel, dealt with correspondence, and gave audiences to ambassadors, councillors, and favourites. One or more of them also slept in the same room as her for reasons of security, as well as propriety. But the Queen was under constant threat of assassination, particularly after 1570, when the Pope issued a bull of excommunication and encouraged her Catholic subjects to rise against her. The women would taste each dish before it was served to the Queen to ensure that it was not poisoned, test any perfume sent to her as a gift, and carry out nightly searches of her private apartments. The women who served Elizabeth at court received only modest payment for the myriad duties that they had to perform. Indeed, some, like the maids of honour and ladies of the presence chamber, were rarely paid at all. The ladies of the privy chamber and bedchamber received an annual salary of around £33, equivalent to around £5,600 today, and this sum remained the same throughout their mistress's long reign. Elizabeth's ladies were allowed bouges of court, which included food, accommodation, lights, and fuel, but their meals tended to comprise leftovers from the Queen's table, which amounted to little when shared between around 20 women. The living quarters allocated to the Queen's ladies were often lacking in even the most basic of facilities. At Windsor Castle, for example, the Maids of Honour's chamber was little more than a makeshift enclosure, which lacked a ceiling and was partitioned by hastily assembled wooden boards. Few women were afforded the luxury of a fireplace in their chambers, so these rooms would become unbearably cold, and there were neither bathrooms nor flushing toilets for the courtiers. As a result, after a few weeks' residence in any palace, the stench would become evil and contagious. Elizabeth and her court were therefore obliged to make regular removes, so that the palaces could be thoroughly cleaned and all the human waste disposed of. Privacy was a rare luxury for the women of Elizabeth's household, and as one contemporary noted, solitude was very hard to do in that place. Life at court was therefore a good deal harder for most of the Queen's ladies than that which they would have enjoyed at their own houses and estates. Moreover, Elizabeth demanded exceedingly high standards and would tolerate no deviation from them. If they failed in any of their duties, she would fly into a rage and deal them slaps or blows. When one poor lady was clumsy in serving her at table, Elizabeth stabbed her in the hand. Although service to the Queen often involved considerable personal sacrifice, there was still a clamour for places. Her ladies could expect to receive gifts of clothing, jewellery, and other accessories from both the Queen and those wishing to gain access to her, and undoubtedly the greatest perk of all for women at court was the unrivalled access to the Queen that their service entailed. From the beginning of her reign, Elizabeth made it clear that she did not wish her ladies to meddle in politics, but it was almost inevitable that she would talk to them about the latest developments at court. Much as she might wish to leave the world of politics and diplomacy behind as she entered her privy chamber, it was not as straightforward as that. As one recent commentator has remarked, guaranteed access to the monarch was guaranteed power.
Tomorrow, Elizabeth is compelled to confront that bosom serpent, Mary, Queen of Scots, and much anguish follows. Part 3 of Elizabeth's Women by Tracy Borman was read by Emma Fielding, abridged by Katie Nicol, and produced by Liz Allard.
One of the judges for the 2014 BBC National Short Story Award, Di Spears.
I think this year, every story, you could argue, has a turning point moment, that sense that you suddenly understand the world at a different level.
Five compelling stories from some of the country's most exciting writers.
Once again, we've managed to attract a great calibre of actor. Kerry Mulligan and Rebecca Hall are both reading, but all the voices will take you somewhere else.
You can hear the shortlisted stories next week from Monday afternoon at 2 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.